when the Buddha describes the states of body and mind that are most difficult to work with in practice, in meditation practice, in relationship, in contemplative life. One of the standard lists used is a list called, that gets translated as the hindrances. The Pali word is nivarana. And it's an excellent list of five things that are very, very familiar in practice. And one of the reasons lists like this is valuable is because one of the mechanisms for practice, it seems like, especially in the early tradition, where these lists are quite common, lists of spiritual powers, lists of things to pay attention to, is that one of the mechanisms of practice, or the ways that mindfulness works, and again, the word mindfulness literally means memory, so to remember, to recollect. One of the ways that mindfulness works is that I'm cruising along practicing, I'm either sitting in meditation or I'm going about my day, and something happens that I notice in a particular way. And that noticing, which is mindfulness, awareness turns on to a specific experience. This can happen in relation to anything, right? I can notice any sight, any sound, any sensory experience, any thought or feeling. But the practice tradition suggests that there are these particular things that are very useful to notice. Some of them are beneficial qualities, some of them are non-beneficial qualities. They're all things that, if we notice them, we can act more clearly in relation to them, and that will open our practice further. So the list called the hindrances is a list of reminders, really, to notice these particular, we could say, energies or qualities. They're states of body-mind as they arise. The standard list goes like this. Sense desires, ill will, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor, doubt. Doubt is the kicker at the end. You've already fallen over with the first four, and then doubt kicks you in the gut. Oh, man. Not only am I down, but I don't even believe in what I'm, you know. So it's a good list. I'm going to talk about them in a couple ways. First, just in a general kind of overview way. The first two are a way of talking about the strong emotional qualities that we experience that really are the heart of the experience of suffering or dissatisfaction. The first one is sense desire, and it's really it speaks to the quality that arises in us when through any of our physical senses and contact with any sense experience, the quality of wanting more of that experience comes, right? One of the most dramatic examples of this, of course, is sensual or sexual desire, lust, where the sensual or sense contact is so strong that it has created 8 billion people and, you know, kind of perpetuates the entirety of life, that sense desire. So it's not a bad thing in context, but in the context of liberation, we can notice that the desire for sense experiences pretty much drives the bus pretty much all the time. So then it's a hindrance because the pathway to seeing clearly depends on both relaxing that outward lean, that grasping, and on letting go. So we can't actually be free in relation to things and relationships and experiences if we are hooked into them. And hooked in doesn't mean that we value them. It means that we are hypnotized by or trapped by them. Right? I value the technology of the phone because it's useful, but to the extent that I have grasping in relation to my phone and I kind of obsess about it and I would be super, super hella bummed to lose it or whatever, that grasping is the thing that will cause suffering, not the valuing itself. Right? I value my friendships. That's a good thing. That's not sense desire in the hindrance sense. That has other qualities like loving kindness, metta. Right? The hindrance of sense desire doesn't say don't value the things of the world or relationships. It says, very specifically with the physical senses, watch out for how we get hooked by specific sense experiences, wanting more of a given taste or a given touch contact or a given smell. The second is its opposite, translated as ill will or aversion, or the old translation, hatred. There's the sense, again, coming through the senses, that something is happening, I don't like it, and I want less of it in my field. And ill will is really the sense of not just disliking something. Again, same as the pleasures. It's not just that something's pleasurable, it's that I get hooked by it. It's not just that something is unpleasant, which is inevitable. Right? We have bodies, they hurt, things are unpleasant. We love people, they disappear, it's unpleasant. So it's not the presence of the unpleasant that is the hindrance. The hindrance, again, is the feeling of hatred. Not only is that thing unpleasant or frightening to me, but I hate it. I want to destroy it. The texts mostly talk about the hindrances in an individual or personal sense as states of mind or heart or body. But of course, cultures are made up of people. And cultures also have states. And I think they have some of the same states, right? Because what is a culture other than the amplification of people? So if we took like sense desire, what is the collective experience of that? I mean, I could say like, oh, consumerism, you know, a way that there's not just the individual desire for stuff, but there's a kind of collective whole structure around desiring stuff, more stuff. The collective experience of ill will, right, it comes out in all of the discriminations, all of the biases, all of the hatreds, militarism, right, to the extreme. Hatred of the other, hatred of anything that makes us feel uncomfortable is the hindrance of ill will. And again, it's not the presence of discomfort that is the hindrance, it's the hating of it. In activist circles right now, discomfort is considered a virtue. Right? Being willing to be uncomfortable is now a virtue. Right? If you're trying to unpack your own privilege, being willing to be uncomfortable is going to get you further than insisting on staying safe and comfortable. So that would be like, become mindful of the hindrance of ill will and see if you can dissolve the hindrance, but stay in the presence of the root feeling, which was discomfort. Then progress will be made. But you have to unbind the hindrance first. We have to figure out how to turn away from hatred toward the underlying feelings. So the first two, sense desire and ill will, grasping at and pushing away direct experience. The third and fourth are two pairs, really. And these are not so much emotional in the classic sense, but energetic. They're also emotions, because energy and emotion aren't separate. The first is excessively high energy. It's called restlessness and worry. So restlessness feels more like the physical side and worry more the mental, but they're embedded together. There's a feeling of speediness, of like grabbing at the future or can't sit still. All of the ways that we respond to some amount of energy in our being, body and mind, that seems to be kind of pushing the boundaries. It's too much for me to rest with. In the same way as the first two, the hindrance is that I can't deal with it or control it or be in wise relationship to it. Energy just by itself is not a problem. Sometimes we have really high energy, sometimes really low. If we're not suffering, we're not suffering, so it's not a hindrance. So it's not high energy itself that is the hindrance. Restlessness is a way of saying, there's high energy and I can't tolerate it. I can't stay with it. In deep meditation, energy can get very big. Burst the sense of the body expanding to fill the universe, waves of energy through the body. The texts describe showering rapture, exploding rapture, pinprickle-like rapture, lightning bolt rapture. These are all meditation experiences. So it's not energy by itself that is a problem. But restlessness is sort of like, oh, there's this energy, it's not quite comfortable. It's kind of like, what do I do with it? Right? It's on the body level, and I'm kind of just jumpy. I can't settle with the energy. Right? Some of the antidote, in the same way as the first two, is going to be, can I come out of the resistance to the experience and drop into the actual physicality of it? And for the energetic ones, it's going to be really physical. Restlessness. Next time you're sitting and you find restlessness happening, the really like juicy, interesting practice is to get really still and relax into it and kind of just be like, whoa. You know, I just want to fidget. Like my whole being is just like, right? And you might open your eyes to do this. And just be like, whoa. My body is just like tripping out. Right? Or, and then of course, even harder is when it's the mind. Worry and anxiety is restlessness. Lots of fast thinking is the same quality, but in thought. And again, the problem is not thought. The problem is this way that it kind of overflows its bounds, or the bounds are too tight, or somehow there's not an ability to see it clearly for what it is. What happens if I relax into the worry body? And I don't pay much attention to the thoughts, but I also don't try to solve them or whatever. It's just like, oh. One of the old metaphors is, you know, one of the ways to calm a wild horse in its little yard, right, is to give it a really big pasture, and it calms down, right? You don't try to tame the energy, you make the boundaries bigger. So you can do this, you make your mind really wide. Again, opening the eyes helps. And again, a kind of a psychedelic wonder can help. Be like, this, wow, I'm so worried. Whoa, I just can't stop worrying. I'm totally convinced that the future is gonna suck. And you can just be like, wow, look at you go, you know, and take a little kind of bemused, you know, like, okay, I have this toddler, right? I talk about him all the time. And he does this thing where, you know, he's just got energy. We're sitting on the couch. It's like 7:30 a.m. I'm kind of like not completely awake yet or whatever. I'm just sort of chilling with him. And he's, and he has this thing where he kind of like, he flaps his arms around and he runs from room to room. And then he looks to see if we're looking. And then he runs full force toward the couch and he flops on his belly laughing hysterically. And then he gets up, makes connection, and then runs off again. You know, and he does this until he trips on something and splats on his face because he's, you know, he still splats. And then he pauses for a bit and he kind of goes, and we're like, did you splat? And he goes, yeah. Because he now talks about his experience. And then he gets up and keeps running. And sometimes I'm just like, what are you doing? You're just running around. But then I also just get to be like, yeah, you're one. You know, just like, run. And I'm just chilling on the couch. I don't have to get up and like get into the running game with him. I could choose to, but I don't have to. He doesn't need me to. Yeah, no, it's just, he's just doing his thing. So we can do the same thing. I could be like, oh, look, worry. Whoa, you're just like running all over the place. But some part of me is just like, you know, kind of, maybe I can be the adult in the room. And be like, I mean, maybe, just maybe, you know. I can be like, wow, worry mind. Crazy, you know. Like, eventually you'll tire out. you know. So that's restlessness and worry, right? High energy. The same in the inverse is low energy. The standard English translation is sloth and torpor, which is great. That's the Victorian translation. Again, sloth feels kind of body. It's just like that, like, low, dull, body, blah, feeling. And torpor is a little bit more mind. So it's like the, I just can't think straight. I'm like, don't make me do it. We stayed up till like midnight last night, because it's the only time you have. And then, the leprechaun wakes up at 6, regardless. And I'm the early morning guy, so my sweetheart goes back to bed. I get up, and this morning I was just so tired. I was kind of awake, but I mostly laid on my belly in his room, kind of on the floor. And he has this hidey game, and he's like, "Rivy, hide." And I'm like, "Are you hiding?" And he says, "Yeah." And when he kind of stands behind this potted plant. I can totally see him. He's just standing there. He gets all quiet. And I'm like, "Are you hiding?" "Yeah." And then I have to play along. I have to go like, "Where's Rivy? I can't find him anyway." And then he jumps out with a big smile. And then he runs back and hides again. So I'm lying on the bed, and I'm sort of like barely playing. I have one eye open. I'm just like, "Where's River? Oh, there you are. Oh, you're gone again." But I'm like, I couldn't lift my head. You know, I'm just so tired. This is torpor. I'm like, whole body feels just heavy. And I know it'll sort of wear off eventually, but you know, it's a difficult state. And in meditation, it's a really difficult state, that kind of just like sinking. I spent so many years sinking on the meditation cushion. Sometimes it's just physical. Sometimes it's more subtle. Aspects of like freeze in the psychology, just like, oh, I can't deal with the world. I'm a little overwhelmed. I'm just going to kind of glaze out. Or like we talked about, something uncomfortable is happening in the emotions or the body. And one really great defense against discomfort is to fall asleep psychically or physically, just to kind of like numb out to it. So torpor, sloth and torpor can be an emotional defense, or they can just be you're hecka tired, you have a 1-year-old or a job, or you live in post-industrial capitalism or whatever is exhausting you. You're exhausted. So sloth and torpor. And again, the practice in the contemplative practice and the curiosity about it, this one's hard. Because the very quality you need to observe it clearly, you don't have, which is wakefulness. But the practice, if you can do it, is like, whoa, this is that state where I can't even focus at all. I'm so dull. I'm actually totally freezing out. This is so kind of nice. Because one of the things about freeze and that kind of stuff is it's kind of pleasant. It's sort of like warm and foggy, and you're just like, oh, I'm so tired. Or you're not even mindful of it, and you're just like, huh. Oh, inhaling, exhale. Oh, are we done? Wow, that was a... Well, that happened again. Okay, you know, onward. So it's really hard to be mindful during those states. But if you can, and it's nice practice to do so, they're actually super interesting, right? I was doing it a little bit this morning. I was lying on the bed going, wow, I'm half awake, but I'm half totally kind of asleep. And I'm sort of playing with River, and my body just feels so heavy. And I was sort of just... And I use verbal commentary to stay awake through it. I'm just sort of talking to myself. I'm just like, it's like, I used to do it in meditation. I'd be like, wow, this is that thing where I feel so droopy. I wonder when it'll pass. Because you can't make it pass. I mean, you can get up and like do a bunch of jumping jacks, run around, have some coffee. But that doesn't really solve the hindrance. It kind of shakes you out of it. But the hindrance will melt on its own if you can be mindful of it. And especially when it's a kind of emotional or sort of nervous system freeze, You can override it. I know you're good at that, because I am. But that doesn't resolve the energy. Right? It has to be kind of given its due. One of the ways that we understand freeze in the trauma work is that there's a kind of backlog of sensory processing. There's too much stimulation, and my system kind of has to shut down. Basically, the little rainbow spinny wheel is going, and nothing moves very fast. You click on something, and it takes a while for anything to happen. That's freeze, right? My system's going, oh, I really want to be present with you, but I'm still just trying to figure out what happened in that conversation this morning. And my system is just kind of like, whoa, and it's like moving through pudding to get anything done. So if we have some spaciousness, the antidote is notice it, and don't do anything about it. Like, really, just let it happen, if you can. Be like, oh, wow. And after a little bit, it's almost like it just kind of melts, and then you're back. And then things get a little bit brighter. It's like, oh. And then you just, you know, you go about your, oh, you're hiding. You resume the game. So, two hindrances that are basically emotional, grasping and aversion, emotional sides of grasping and aversion, and two that are kind of physiological, energetic experiences of excessive high and excessive low energy, or our unskillful relationship to the extremes of energy. And the fifth is doubt, or skeptical doubt. Doubt is so toxic in contemplative practice that it is given. It's personified as a minor deity in the Buddhist texts, a semi-divine figure. We could call it a demon, but it's not quite right. That's too evil in a certain way. Although this is the one who is called evil in the translations. There's a figure called Mara. It's a sort of related descendant of the god of death, doubt and death, related deities. Just let that kind of settle in. Mara is the one that comes and says, "You don't think you can really do this, do you? You're not good enough to do this. It's not going to work." Mara is the one that says, "Oh, look, you're slacking off. Who's so good now?" Right. All of this is pretty much directly from the texts. Mara comes and visits the Buddha many, many times in his life, including after he's enlightened. The Buddha's totally enlightened, free of all defilements and suffering, whatever. He's in the middle of his teaching life, and one afternoon he has some back pain. The Buddha has a bad back, it turns out. And at one point he decides that rather than giving the Dharma talk, the teaching, he wants to go and rest his back. So he tells his assistant, Ananda, to give the teaching, and he goes back to his hut, and he lies down. And then Mara shows up at the door and says something like, "Ah, blessed one, feeling a little pain, are we? Are you afraid of it? Why are you slacking off on teaching? Aren't you the one with great equanimity?" Right? Teases him, essentially, about his attainment, questions his attainment, doubts his attainment. The Buddha does what the Buddha always does, which is see clearly. It's kind of his thing. And he says, "I see you, Mara." And Mara says, in this sort of mythic way, the same thing he always says, which he says, "The Blessed One has seen me." And then the text says, and then Mara slinks away. Oh, the Blessed One has seen me. So the big antidote to doubt is to see it. And you have to name it. Right? Doubt is like Rumpelstiltskin. You have to know its name and say it, and then it loses some of its power. So that thing where you're like, "I suck," you can be like, "Hello, Mara. I'm not good enough. I kind of tricked my way into this job, but they don't know that I really don't know what I'm doing. You say, hello, Mara. This is doubt. And one of the things that's really important about doubt is that it doesn't matter whether you're right or not. It doesn't matter whether your assessment of things might even be accurate. You might indeed be unqualified for the job. That's not at issue. What's at issue is that you're being tormented by a mind state. And there's no way to get on with the job, whether or not you're qualified for it, while under the influence of the mind state of doubt. So you have to defeat Mara first. And then, once you're thinking clearly, you can assess more in a more sober manner. I think doubt in our culture shows up as a kind of extreme of cynicism and nihilism. Like, there are whole sectors of our culture now that, like, kind of refuse to believe in anything, not hold anything precious. Everything can be criticized. Everything can be undercut. Nothing is good enough. I see this on the activist left. Nothing is ever good enough. No matter how righteous you are, someone can find the place where you're not, or your blind spot. And again, it's not the calling out of a weakness that is the hindrance. That can be done in a very clear-minded way, to say, this is worthy of seeing clearly. That's not doubt. Doubt is where it creeps into a kind of tearing down judgment, right? To say, you did something unskillful has undoubtedly at some point been true and can be just information. But to say, you're worthless. You did this and you are, you know, whatever you call yourself. It's not nice. And it's not the truth, right? It's a judgment that, if it was a legal argument, we would call it ad hominem. It's insulting the person rather than the kind of making a clear argument against the action. So again, to see it, we want to see it clearly, be like, oh, this is doubt. And seeing it, we want to wake up to it. Waking up to it is going to mean feeling the quality of it in the body. It's usually pretty yucky. And then, as with all the hindrances, we can see it, feel it, let it dissolve somewhat, and we can also bring into its place more wholesome qualities. We can remember our sincerity. For doubt particularly, I want us to remember our sincerity, our intention. Right? My sincere intention to be kind or not harm or practice deeply. If I can reorient to it, blows away the doubt. And it will see more clearly my mistakes. It'll say, oh, I did that poorly. I could even say it in less judgmental language, although I like the judgmental language. Sometimes myself, I just do it. Sometimes it's doubt, sometimes it's clear. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. But what I want to do is say, oh, that was unskillful. Or I did that action and it had this effect. That's really the crispest, right? And then I can say my sincere intention is not to cause harm, but I want to really learn how my actions and their effects are related. I can do all of that without self-hatred and doubt. So, on the individual level, seeing clearly the qualities of grasping, pushing away, restlessness and dullness and doubt when they arise. On the collective level, seeing the qualities of grasping in our consumer culture, the qualities of hatred in our relationship with others who are different from us. We can see restlessness and dullness in the qualities of like hyperstimulation and busyness. and then their the corollary in, you know, how many kind of depressives we need, alcohol, tobacco, entertainment that dulls the intensity, that puts us to sleep. And then, of course, doubt in all the ways that our culture encourages us to doubt, because, of course, if you don't like yourself, you buy more shit. So, for all of them, the antidote is to see them clearly, make space for them to melt through the body, maybe back into the earth, and for the demon that fuels them to be seen and disarmed. And all of the antidotes, they're not mysterious, right? The antidotes are ethical action, kindness, clear seeing, bright awareness, concentration. All of the wholesome qualities of the path. So, thanks for listening. Taking a moment just to land together in silence, and then we'll talk together. Your thoughts and feelings, and anything about your practice, or that this inspires for you.
Sometimes I feel it's hard to keep like the mental boundaries of noticing and like actually like analyzing.
Yeah.
And like breaking it down and turning it into a commentary of like,
yeah,
I'm doing this because of this, because of this, because of this.
Yep.
And it just gets really frustrating at times, and then I feel like I've just got caught with the thought and just ran off.
Yep. Yep.
So do you have any?
Yeah, it's hard to both maintain the mental clarity and boundaries of noticing and then the kind of deconstruction or analyzing that can come with this type of practice where you want to see what causes something and it can become kind of a rabbit hole of then further thinking. What you want to notice is that there's the initial noticing itself, which is mindfulness, it's a wholesome quality, and then there's the sort of next step of kind of tracing it back a little bit, seeing where it arises from. Like, oh, I see this person, I notice that I like them, and I notice the presence of a little bit of grasping, let's say. I take it down those steps. And then I start to analyze it further and sort of like follow the winding trail of karmic, you know, causation into like, well, I like this kind of person because of this thing, and that exact color on their hat is really compelling, probably because my mother wore that color on her Sunday hat at Easter. I hate Christian practice. Why the Easter bunny? Oh my God, it's so... And, you know... so what you want to do... I got you with that one. I don't know where that's going. Just, like, stop. What you want to do is, like, trace it back to the hindrance itself or whatever the basic quality is. And then if the mind, like, hooks onto that and starts to run, then you have to label that, right? Not the content, not like, oh, I'm understanding more and more about my psychology. You have to be like, whoop, restlessness, right? So it'll just flip from the wholesome quality of mindfulness right back into another hindrance. And so it's sort of like seeing, grasping, letting go, stop. Come back to the breath and the body. Start again. Right. Oh, seeing something else. Noticing liking. Noticing the impulse to grasp and relaxing. Stop. Like, let's say, no more than 3 steps, right? And just cut it. Come back to the body, forget whatever it was, and start again. Because again, if it goes on, it's just going to be another hindrance. Right? The hindrance of trying to figure it out too much is so common in the mind. Right? There's this, it's almost this impulse that, like, if I figure it out, everything will be okay. Yeah? That's restlessness and grasping and fear kind of all whisked together with some salt and cream. Tasty. So yeah, watch out. One of my teachers would sometimes say, oh, yeah, multiple hindrance attack. Like they're all sort of here at once, right? I'm simultaneously restless, sleepy, hating myself, lusty, and doubting everything. Right? And it's just like, ah! Yeah, that. So, you know, sit up, take a deep breath. Yeah. Hi, guys. Hi, hindrances. You know. The Tibetan tradition has amazing, good, slightly more shamanic stories about this. There's a story about Milarepa, the great forest renunciate. He's practicing in a cave. He comes home from his alms round one day to find his cave full of demons, ghosts, dragons, monsters, beings with teeth, the embodiments of all the hindrances. And he's like, oh no, the hindrances have arrived. And he starts to go through his tools. He does some shamanic spells, a few of them disappear. He's brightly mindful of some of them and sees them clearly, and a few of them disappear. He sits down to meditate and concentrates and gathers his mind and ignores them, and a few of them disappear. He does all of his tricks, and then he opens his eyes, and there's only one remaining, and it's just sitting there in the doorway with its mouth open. And he's run through all of his methods, and he just looks at it, and it's just looking at him like... And this... So you know which one this is for you, right? Whichever it is. The story says... He understands who this one is. He goes over and he puts his head in its mouth. And then it goes. He goes too. So, there's that. There's the last antidote, ultimately. Right? A kind of surrender. A kind of loving surrender to yourself. But till then, spell casting, concentration, all of that. Other thoughts that you have? Do you have one? Or was that you?
Did you raise your hand?
I was curious that it seemed that, like, that the restlessness is kind of like that. I feel like the restlessness versus, like, the sloth and the torpor was, like, basically how my nervous system is. And it just seemed the way you described it, that it was like, you know, either up or like freeze.
Yeah.
So it was so interesting just to see that that parallel.
It's so like, this list is so good that it kind of names very precisely these qualities. Like, oh, that's what I do. I sort of flip-flop between like, ah, and you know, right? So, yeah, as with all of these, there's going to be a middle ground that is more sustainable for practice. Yeah.
Could restlessness be like flight or fight?
I think it's kind. I think it's kind of both, okay. Right? Because they both have the physiological experience of muscular activation. Mm-hmm. Right. That's the physiology of fight and flight is muscular innervation. So blood flow to the limbs, faster heartbeat and breath. So all of that is going to have that kind of restless quality if it comes and I'm not physically moving. You know, if I'm threatened and I'm now running along the street, that's not restlessness, right? That's just like the muscles doing their thing that they should do. This is more like I'm sitting and I start to get a little achy or emotional or just lose focus, and the momentum of my life builds up in my body as this kind of restlessness. And it's the same thing. We would, if in the trauma language, we would call it sympathetic nervous system activation, right? That I need to kind of be aware of and allow to drain away or deactivate. So in this language, it's just recognized as a quality of kind of resisting high energy, right? We would say, well, I'm at threshold with energy, and if I go past it, I'll get overwhelmed. If it gets too high, I'll get overwhelmed. So I need to let it settle.
Question: like I'm in my work, I'm always dealing with people in crisis. Everybody's in crisis, and I'm there to solve their crisis. I'm just curious about your first approach to someone else's. I deal with high school age kids. So
yeah.
When they're in crisis, how would you recommend coming to somebody when in crisis? Because to get to where they are,
yeah,
to get to them,
yeah.
Because a lot of what we're doing here, a lot of what this is about, understanding the self. But it's like,
yeah. How
do you get others to understand,
yeah,
where they are?
Yeah, the tool is the same for yourself and others. Really, we could say that all of these states of kind of distress and intensity are ways that my attention has gotten hooked into a kind of physiological emotional process. I'm lost in myself, basically. And so, and this is the basis, this is the sort of foundation that we use in trauma work, which is that the first stabilizing tool, you know, I can't do anything until I come out of the crisis state. And it's a physical state. It's fight and flight and freeze. So until I come out of those states, I can't do anything else. And so then the triage for getting out is orientation to the external. In other words, get the person, whatever state they're in, to bring their attention to something that's not themselves. And really through the senses, visual is the easiest, right? It's so somebody's like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And you're like, look at that bird. And they're like, what? Immediately their system will start to settle. And so it could be like, oh, let's go for a walk and get outside and talk about shit, talk about bands, talk about it. But really it's get your eye gaze to go out. You know. The formal practice of this, if you have people that are open to it, would be set aside the thing that feels really important is obsessing you right now. We're gonna come to that. But first, I want you to let your eyes go where they want around the room. And name a few things you see. It's like, oh, I see some blue-gray bolsters, see the reflection of the gate in the window, and one vertical speaker and one horizontal one. Right? And instantly, my kind of stress level is going to settle. Because part of what I'm doing is I'm secretly telling my body that I'm safe. Right, I'm looking around for threat, essentially. So attention out is the shorthand that some traditions use. Attention out settles things, and then you can start to work. If you want to listen to a longer version of that, through the month of, was it June?
Yeah.
We did a thing that I was teased for calling Trauma Month. One of the students here was like, work on your branding. But... but I did four talks on trauma physiology in practice, so you can look at
that. That's just crazy applicable to my work. So.
Awesome. We can chat, but they're all up on my website also. So attention out is kind of the first intervention. And that's an intervention for internal and external and for all the hindrances, right? There's restlessness, attention out. Hella grasping, attention out. Doubt storm, attention out. Mm-hmm. And it'll interrupt whatever is happening. Mm-hmm. Doubt Storm. Yeah. Anything next, it's a good band. Heavy. Anything else? Yeah.
Just a quick question. When did, approximately, like, did this list of hindrances, like, come out or were identified or were shared?
It's in the early Buddhist texts, so they were written down about 100 BCE and were oral tradition as far as we can tell, since the Buddha himself taught the list, which is about 500 BC. So this is a 2,500-year-old list. Good list, huh? Yeah. Cool. So we'll go on next week on into more. Again, feel free to join any of the study classes as you like, and we'll go from there. Thank you for your generosity in supporting this group. Your gift of your resources as abundantly as you can supports those who have less to come and practice and unbinds us from the hook of consumer capitalism a little bit. Thank you for that. Everything you can give goes in the basket. If it fits in the basket, if it doesn't, you can overflow the basket. I'll see you next week. Take good care.